Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and Frank, you're joining me remotely this week, right?
That's right. I'm in Stockholm this week, David.
All right. So, the book topping the New York Times bestseller list and every other bestseller list right now is Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House, a expose of the first year of the Trump administration. I have to admit, I have not yet read Fire and Fury, although I've read some of the excerpts that have been published online, listened to lots of commentary. Frank, you have read the book. What are your immediate thoughts on it?
I think it's a very interesting book. I think it's an interesting historical artifact. It's not a very good book. It's not well written. It's, as we'll get into, I think, in the next few minutes, Wolff's methodology is open to question. Mm. I think it's very much a book of this time, in this allegedly post-truth moment. I think it's a very interesting book. I think the portrait of Donald Trump that it paints and the Trump administration is probably accurate in the kind of big picture, but incorrect in some of its details. I think when we look back on this, if indeed this is a major turning point, the importance of the book will be that Wolff brought into the open what seemingly the Washington Press Corps has been talking about for at least a year, which is Trump's competence and possibly even his sanity. And now that's a kind of open discussion rather than one that everyone seemed to be having kind of behind closed doors. Mm. So I think that'll be its that will likely be its major contribution. I'm ambivalent about whether people should spend money on this book. I was, in fact, I suspect you shouldn't.
Okay.
You know what? Go to the library. First of all, don't download the WikiLeaks one because I think you'll get viruses. But to be totally honest with you, can I be frank
yes.
with you? That joke never gets old. I think to be frank with you, most of the juicy stuff was leaked. If you read the extracts in New York Magazine and other places online, you've got the sense of the book and listened to podcasts like this one. You probably don't need to go give Michael Wolff your money, and Michael Wolff seems to be a slightly disreputable character anyway, so I'm not sure you want to give him your money. I read it on behalf of you, dear listener, so that you wouldn't have to. I think it's an interesting historical artifact. I think it's a flawed work of history, but I think you don't necessarily need to go out and spend $13.99. That's in pounds sterling to get it on your Kindle.
All right.
Okay,
but let's try if we can people have talked a lot about this book over the past couple weeks. Let's see if we can put this book into some kind of historical context. The genre of book this is seems to be in line, at least in some respects, with lots of the things that Bob Woodward has been doing over the past, I guess, 40 years now, 45 years. How would you, I know you're a big fan of Woodward's various studies of the White House, both of the Bush administrations and the Obama administrations. How do you think this compares to Bob Woodward's corpus of investigative studies of the presidency?
Right. I would slightly push back on your characterization of me as a big fan of Woodward. I mean, I think Woodward is problematic in some way. Woodward, of course, is a giant in the history of American journalism, and his role, along with Carl Bernstein, in breaking the Watergate story for the Washington Post, and his writings about that, particularly All the President's Men, but also The Final Days, those are seminal works in the history of American politics and journalism. His later work, which was very much built on his reputation as one of the two Watergate reporters, is gripping. It's fly on the wall stuff. It's based on hundreds of interviews, and Bob Woodward is the best connected person in journalism, in American journalism, and that comes across. And because of that, he has a certain credibility. However, when one reads a Woodward book, not unlike Michael Wolff's book, it's very difficult to determine what his sources are. Hmm. Now, he attributes quotes to people, so he'll say, David Silkenat said, da-da-da-da-da. And you know that, or we take it as given, that that's based on an interview that Woodward conducted with the individual in question. But I think, you know, there are no footnotes in most of Woodward's books. And there's no direct attribution of quotes in most cases. Mm. And I think Woodward is an interesting character or figure in the evolution of this type of journalism, because Woodward has credibility, which he acquired over a lifetime of working in journalism and breaking some of the biggest stories in the history of American political journalism. And so Woodward has a status and a credibility that's very, very difficult to question. However, his methodology leads almost inexorably to a book like Michael Wolff's, which, if you look at it superficially, resembles Woodward's work in some way. So, quotes, you know, he recreates conversations, some of which he witnessed, some of which apparently he did not. I don't think Wolff's assertion in his preface that he, you know, some of these accounts are contradictory is necessarily problematic. We as historians deal with contradictory accounts all the time. And a lot of the kind of right-wing press in attacking this book have fixated on that and saying, see, he, you know, this is wrong. It's not about right and wrong necessarily, but I think Woodward pioneered a style of journalistic political writing that Wolff is emulating, and in a way that's slightly problematic. What do you think,
Dave? Well,
what do you think of Woodward?
I've only read the excerpts from Fire and Fury, but I would agree with you that Woodward, which I've read a lot of, you know, is they're in a similar vein. Although Woodward writes, I think, much more persuasively and much more articulately. But one of the problems that both of these texts have, as you point out, is that we can't, as historians, use them as sources in a meaningful way, because we can't deconstruct where lots of the evidence comes from. One of the ways in which these books differ from histories is that, you know, you can look at a work that historians write and see where they're building their argument from by following the footnotes and following the money, as it were, to use a Woodward phrase. You know, part of the reason why Woodward was able to get such profound access to a variety of White Houses was because, you know, of his role in Watergate and uncovering the Watergate story, and in particular the way he treated his sources in Watergate. And the most famous source, of course, that he used in Watergate was an FBI agent, Mark Felt, who for decades was identified only in All the President's Men, both the book and the subsequent movie, as Deep Throat, you know, and as this anonymous source, and it's very dramatic in the movie how he meets with him in a garage and whatnot. But Woodward protected his identity for decades, and constantly people try to pester him, try to ascertain who the identity of Deep Throat was. And, you know, his determination to protect his sources was one of the reasons why, I think, for decades on, people trusted him to, where they, if they had a problem with the internal workings of the White House, they could go to Woodward and say, this is on background, but I'm going to give you all this information. And they could do that with some degree of certainty that Woodward wouldn't reveal their identity. So he had this special place within American political reporting because of this, you know, legacy of Watergate. But I think one thing that both Woodward and Wolff are guilty of, to various degrees, is of making some of these conversations, making some of these political disputes within the White House more dramatic than they actually may have been. I've heard people who were in the White, you know, accounts later from people in the White House responding to some of these Woodward's books, saying, "I was in those conversations and they were not as heated as Woodward makes them sound like. There was a disagreement about trade policy or appointments of various kinds or whatever, but it was not as divisive as and as chaotic as Woodward made it seem to be." And obviously,
or dramatic. Right, sometimes, yeah. These things often come out as almost, you know, Aaron Sorkin written dialogue in The West Wing, when actually these encounters are much more off, much more frequently like episodes of The Office.
Yes, or no, without the humor though. Just, you know, yes, much more prosaic. More like an actual office rather than, you know, The Office.
Yeah, rather than The Office. So, I mean, one of the things I do read Woodward and I enjoy Woodward's work, but I approach it with a degree of skepticism. How useful do you think it will be to historians a century from now?
Well, I think one of the things that Woodward is interested in, and Wolf is obviously interested in, some of the precursors to Woodward are also interested in, is this question of personality and the role that personality has in the White House, and the ways in which personalities of the president and of his aides and cabinet members and various assorted other figures, the way those sort of factor into how the White House runs. You know, the skeptical political historian in me, and I'm not a political historian by training or orientation, says those things don't matter as much as actual policy outcomes do. That the sort of internal machinations, the sort of court intrigue, are good drama but bad history. So I'm not quite sure how much in any of these books we really learn about. Yeah, it seems like a lot of gossip and not a whole lot of substance.
Although, at risk of defending Woodward here, I think there is a distinction to be made between Woodward and Wolf.
Oh, to be sure.
Because I think Wolf's account is pretty gossipy. There isn't a whole lot of substance and policy there, in part because there hasn't been a whole lot of policy from the Trump administration thus far.
To be sure.
And by his own account, it's basically, he's provided the perspective of somebody more or less sitting on a couch in the West Wing and noting down what he's seen. And whereas Woodward, to some extent, and so particularly in his work, you know, his book about the Obama administration was about the administration's response to the crash of 2008, for example, primarily.
Sure.
As well as the book about Afghanistan. So he's often approached policy, or he's written about policy, but he's couched it in these terms of personality clashes and conflict and the kind of narrative of conflict within whatever White House he happens to be writing about, or administration he's writing about.
The other sort of recent analog to me to Fire and Fury is Primary Colors from 1996.
Right, by Joe Klein.
Which, well, I mean, of course, it was published anonymously about the 1992 Clinton campaign, and it uses pseudonyms and weird things. But it's doing similar kinds of gossipy work where it's... you know, there isn't a whole lot of substance to that book, but everybody read it because of the tabloid appeal of it. You know, and I think, looking back on it, I don't think either Fire and Fury or Primary Colors is going to be used extensively by historians decades from now. I think it'll be written off as a little more than gossip.
Well, yes, although I think one of the I'll amplify my comments from before, or add to them, if you'll allow, which is to say, I think one of the real contributions of Fire and Fury is the bringing out to the open of the discussion of Trump's competence and health. The other is, I think it's all more valuable as a snapshot of the campaign and the latter stages of the campaign and the transition, than of the Trump White House. So that revelation that they didn't expect to win.
Yeah.
And the portrait of a kind of campaign that was wholly unprepared to win is quite a valuable insight, and I think quite credible. Not least because everybody believed that, 14 months ago. And I think it was interesting, and I think primary colors works as well in that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I think Fire and Fury works. It's not necessarily fits in the Woodward genre of an insider's look at a presidential administration so much as, like primary colors, it's more in the genre of journalistic accounts of presidential campaigns.
Okay.
I think there's a kind of subtle distinction to be made there.
I think you're right. Thinking about this as an account of a campaign and thinking about trying to fit that into what sort of the origin of historically these are, there's two texts to me that jump out from the 1960s that I think set the stage for both the kind of journalism Woodward was doing and has done and Michael Wolff has done. And the first of those is Joe McGinnis's The Selling of the President, 1968, which was published in 1969 about the Nixon campaign the previous year. And slightly earlier than that, Ted White's book, The Making of the President, about the Kennedy campaign in 1960.
And White, of course, wrote subsequent volumes on 64, 68, and 72.
Sure.
All with the same title. To some extent, the text, the original text for this entire genre, I think you're absolutely right, is Ted White's Making of the President in 1960, which is the kind of journalist and journalistic account, but it's the journalist as insider. Those books also don't have any footnotes and citations, but provide incredibly insightful, and one could also observe, at least with the Making of the President in 1960, sympathetic accounts of the the Kennedy campaign in particular. I think you're right that they begin there. So do you want to say a little bit more about this?
I think it's worth talking about McGinnis's book, which comes out in 1969, because that was on the bestseller list for most of the year. And what that book does, when he's looking at the Nixon campaign, and if you read today, it seems somewhat obvious, but it was shocking at the time, that the presidency was sold like dishwasher detergent. There was, a coherent advertising campaign to make Nixon palatable to an audience and to voters, and it was about marketing a certain brand of the president, and the real president was something different than what you saw on television. So when Nixon appeared in Laugh-In, he says that this is all very calculated. When he appears in advertising, when he appears in speeches, all that is market-driven to create a particular effect and to drive voters in particular ways. All of which I think today sounds obvious, and we expect that the person that we see on television, the candidate, is being marketed to us in some ways. But one of the things about McGinnis's book, I think, that makes it original and meaningful, and the reason why it attracted so much attention, was I think people were not fully aware of the extent to which the ethos of Madison Avenue was informing political campaigns.
And I guess the differences, or one of the crucial differences between McGinnis's account and Ted White, for example, Ted White gave us an apparently behind-the-scenes view, but actually it was also helping to create and foster a kind of myth, particularly about Kennedy.
Sure.
And so where McGinnis was pulling the mask away, to some extent what Teddy White did was pull the mask away and show us another mask, if you will. I'm getting tied up in the metaphor there, but you understand what I'm saying.
I know. I think he's part of the mythology of Camelot comes out of the what you know Ted White wrote. One of the interesting sort of odd connections with Joe McGinnis's book and Michael Wolff's book is Roger Ailes served as a source for both of them. Roger Ailes, of course, the former head of Fox News, who
right.
was a young Nixon media person in 1968 and a very old and now deceased Trump supporter in the last election. So there's there is a source connection between those two texts.
Go ahead, David.
Well, I was thinking, just, you know, in between that, you know, the 8 years that separate Ted White, though, and Joe McGinnis, one of the things that happens, I think, that fundamentally changes political reporting and reporting more broadly, and I think this actually connects with some of the things that President Trump has been talking about recently, is the case of Sullivan versus the New York Times in 1964.
Right, so how do you think that affected things, David?
Well, so the background to this Supreme Court case was an advertisement placed in the New York Times in 1960. And it was an ad, a full-page ad, placed by a civil rights group supporting Martin Luther King and critical of state government in Alabama. And there were some very minor factual errors in the ad. The ad said, for instance, that King had been arrested 7 times. He, in fact, had only been arrested 4 times. The ad said that a group of African-American protesters had sang My Country, Tis of Thee at a protest when, in fact, they had sung the national anthem. Minor stupid things. A local official in Alabama sued the New York Times for libel under Alabama law because he said this ad was not 100% factual and I was defamed as a consequence, and received a court settlement in Alabama because of that. And what the Supreme Court ruled in Sullivan versus the New York Times was that the standard for libel has to be not just something that's factually incorrect. The standard for libel has to be that there has to be an intent of malice. There has to be actual malice intended when factually incorrect statements are made. Which fundamentally shifted how libel law worked in the United States. Up to that point, you could have sued somebody for libel if they had simply said something factually incorrect about you that you felt was harmful to you. Now you had to prove not only that it was factually incorrect and harmful to you, but that it was intended with the effect of harming you. What this means in terms of journalism is it allowed journalists a lot more freedom to do critical investigations of individuals in the White House, of individual politicians more broadly, without the fear of being threatened with a libel lawsuit. So it allowed journalists to take more risks. It allowed publishers to take more risks. And I think part of the, you know, kind of journalism we've seen in the past 50 years has been a consequence of the sort of liberalization of what is permissible under libel laws, which I think speaks to some of the things that President Trump has been talking about, where he wants to make the libel laws harsher.
Take a look at the libel laws, as he keeps saying, because he's been clearly stung by the portrait in Wolf's book.
Yes,
and threatened legal action, of course, as he often does, but he keeps using this phrase that he wants to take a look at the libel laws, not quite understanding the president's role in drafting legislation, but that's interesting. I mean, I think the genre does, we might look backwards a little further, but I also want to look further forward a little bit from, so you've got Teddy White series that ends really with he wrote about Watergate as well, but he wrote The Making of the President in 1960, 64, 68, and 72. You get the McGinnis book in 1969. I mean, Mark Halperin and John Heilman more recently wrote kind of, if you will, Teddy White-style accounts of the 2008 and 2012 campaigns very, very successfully, and those were great bestsellers. They were working on a book on the 2016 election. This brings together some of our themes of recent weeks, but Mark Halperin was brought down by the by allegations of sexual misconduct.
Mm.
And Penguin canceled their contract for their kind of book on the 2016 election. But I think their two volumes on 2008 and 2012 are very much in that genre as well. I'd ask you, though, David, we think about Woodward, we're thinking about Halperin and Heilman. If you go back, we're talking about Teddy White and Joe McGinnis, and there are others, I'm sure, that we aren't remembering. Is this a guy thing? I mean, there's a kind of, what we see are kind of middle-aged or older male journalists who are part of the Washington elite, who write these exposés, and I'm using inverted commas or quotation marks for exposés. They write these insider accounts. Does the fact that they're all men of a certain age, is that... how significant is that? Katie Turgis wrote a book about the 2016 campaign, so maybe that isn't. Maybe it's not just a guy thing. But I'm wondering about the gender dimension to this. Does that simply reflect the power dynamics of the past 60 years, and it will change, or is this an inherently male genre?
I think there's a couple of things going on here. One, obviously, is that the political press corps in D.C. has been, although it's not as much anymore, but has been over the past 50-plus years, overwhelmingly male, middle-aged white guys. So it shouldn't be a surprise that the kind of people who end up writing these books as insider books are male, middle-aged white guys. The other thing that may be going on is that these books are, some of them, especially I think the Michael Wolff variety of them, somewhat gossipy. And I think there's a fear among women journalists of writing books that sound too gossipy, and I think that plays to certain kind of gender stereotypes and whatnot. And so I think serious women journalists have tended to be hesitant to write these kinds of books, and they'd rather do more serious policy questions. So you don't find people like, you know, Helen Thomas writing these kinds of books. You find them much more interested in the mechanics of power rather than, the rumors about who's unhappy with who else.
So it's kind of paradox there that it's male journalists who can indulge in gossip, not female journalists.
I mean, one of the things I think is this reason why these start to happen, thinking about why we start to see these in the 1960s, you know, has to do, I think, with the role of television and the White House as one factor, that we see the presidency in a different way than we did prior to the rise of modern media. And the other factor I think is critically important in order to sort of get these kinds of books has to do simply with the number of people in the White House and the ways in which the presidency as an organizational institution has grown exponentially in the 20th century. And so you have a lot more sources to go to get dirt on what's going on in the White House and much more politics within the White House than you would have had in any other point in American history. I mean, you can't, if you imagine, say, like, what the insider look at the Lincoln White House would have been like. Well, Lincoln had two, sometimes three secretaries that worked for him, and his family living in the White House, and that was it. Whereas,
right. Hey, and Nicolay wrote about their time in the White House, but they did it well after.
They did it well afterwards. Right. And, you know, they did that in a fairly reverential sort of way. Whereas, you know, the White House today employs thousands of people. And there's a huge amount of internal politics within the White House and factions and whatnot that you don't see in a, you know, 19th century White House.
Yeah, the only thing that I could think of when I was reading Fire and Fury, and, you know, Steve Bannon is clearly quoted quite a lot in this, and indeed in the past week he's lost his job at Breitbart as a result of this. The only analog I could think of from my own period was Alexander Hamilton wrote an attack. He wrote in the form of a letter. He wrote an attack that was published as a pamphlet during the election of 1800 on John Adams, who, of course, was the president, sitting president, and the standard bearer for Hamilton's own party, the Federalists. And in that attack, which is an amazing document, I recommend people read it, if only to demonstrate that nothing's new under the sun. But Hamilton questioned Adams's competence and indeed his sanity. And to some extent, and I don't know how our friend Joanne Freeman will feel about this because I'm likening Hamilton to Steve Bannon. Hamilton's in the role of Steve Bannon then, attacking the sitting president, and questioning his sanity. But there's a difference, I think, between what Hamilton did 200 years ago, or almost 220 years ago, and Michael Wolff's book, in the sense that Hamilton was a political actor.
Yeah, not a journalist.
Writing, and he wasn't a journalist. Now, in that period, of course, journalists were very active politically and wrote all sorts of scurrilous things and gossip and so on. But there is a slight difference. So to some extent, Hamilton is the founding father, if you will, of the genre of a political memoir that seeks to settle scores. And Wolff's book is a little bit different from that. So I do think there's a kind of difference in genre between the two, although the nature of the attack and questioning the president's competence and sanity, and given Bannon's role in Wolff's book, which is clear, I think that the kind of Hamilton as Bannon, or Bannon as Hamilton, works a little bit in terms of the analogy. But that's the only analog I could think of, because you're right that in the 18th and particularly in the 19th centuries, we don't see the same level of score settling and gossiping, at least by members of the administration. And the nature of journalism was different before 1960.
Yeah. Well, and I was trying to think about earlier analogs as well, and the one that period that jumps out to me is the muckraking period, the first sort of decade of the 20th century, in which investigative journalists, who in some ways are not all that dissimilar from the kinds of work that, you know, Bob Woodward and others were doing in the late 20th century, are investigating corruption, but they're doing it not in the White House, they're doing it either in business or in more often local government. And, you know, the two sort of big examples that jump out to me are Lincoln Steffens' book, The Shame of the Cities, which investigated local corruption in places like St. Louis and Cleveland and Chicago, the ways in which local government was fundamentally corrupt, and the ways in which he was able to sort of get sources, in some ways, is not all that dissimilar. And Ida Tarbell's book, The History of Standard Oil, both of these come out in 1904, I believe. Where Tarbell is looking at Standard Oil, the huge Rockefeller oil conglomerate, and looking at the ways in which it was using its power and leverage in fundamentally corrupt ways. And the thing that strikes me that links these is, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, power was much more concentrated in the hands of local and state government and much more in the hands of business. And so if you wanted to get juicy corruption, that's where you went. Whereas today, to be sure, there's still a great amount of corporate power, but, you know, if you're going to get the sort of drama that you end up with in Michael Wolff's book, you have to look in the White House.
Right. Interesting.
All right, Frank, what do you got? What do you got for a last drop?
Well, I want to talk about the U.S. Embassy in London, David. As some people will know, many of our listeners, the U.S. Embassy is moving from its current home in Grosvenor Square to a site in Wandsworth in South London in the next few weeks. And President Trump tweeted about this morning, but I was thinking about this earlier in the week because the current U.S. ambassador in the U.K. tweeted a video of what he called the it was the lowering of the flag over the current U.S. embassy. Mm. And he mentioned that this was the kind of had been the site of the embassy for the past 60 years, really since the end of the Second World War. And that's true in terms of speaking about the specific building, but of course, John Adams lived in Grosvenor Square, which is where the current embassy is, and it was his embassy. It was the embassy of the United States during his tenure as ambassador in 1785, or beginning in 1785. Mm. So the association of the United States and the American embassy in London with Grosvenor Square really goes back to the very beginning. It goes back 240 years. So this move from Grosvenor Square to South London is quite significant because it ends almost 250 years of an American presence in Grosvenor Square. So I think that's interesting. The other thing I would observe, I would make two further observations related to this last drop, which is the new embassy, if you're a Star Trek fan, looks remarkably like a Borg cube. Now, American embassies are often very ugly. I'm here in Stockholm right now, where the American embassy is notoriously ugly. The one in Ottawa is a monstrosity. In fact, they're often ugly for very good reasons, which is security. And so the need for security means that these buildings are built to withstand attack and to prevent attack. And they're which is an interesting comment, but they. The emphasis is on security rather than aesthetic, a pleasing aesthetic, and I think the new building might reflect that. Have a look at it online if you can. The second thing I'd make by way of an observation is President Trump tweeted this morning or last night that he's not coming to the ribbon cutting for this. He claims he's doing so because the Obama administration made a bad deal on the current embassy in selling the current embassy in Grosvenor Square to before making the move, and that he's not going to endorse that deal. And so it fits into his narrative of everything Obama's done is bad. By way of explanation, I think it should be said, first of all, the deal to move the embassy was made prior to the Obama administration. It was made during the second Bush administration. And the other observation I would make is I think Trump's looking for a way out of coming to the United Kingdom because he's incredibly unpopular there, and he's aware at some level that he'll be greeted with massive protests, and he doesn't want to come. And so I think alleged Obama link with the movement of the embassy is a pretext so that he could pull out of coming to London. Anyway, the American embassy is moving for the first time in decades. It's leaving Grosvenor Square for the first time in nearly 250 years. And so it's notable, and it's moving into a very strange-looking building. So for all those reasons, that's my last drop.
Okay.
What's your last drop, David?
There was a story that appeared earlier this week about a bestseller and a 10-year-old book that's now back on the bestseller list, or actually bestseller list for the first time, and it's a book called Fire and Fury, and it's not the Michael Wolff Fire and Fury. It's a book by a Canadian historian named Randall Hansen about the Allied bombing campaign in World War II. But presumably lots of people who were ordering Michael Wolff's book on Amazon typed in Fire and Fury and ordered the wrong one by mistake. And so this historian's 10-year-old book is now doing quite well as a sort of spin-off consequence of the rush for everyone to get Michael Wolff's book about the Trump administration. So here's hoping to all future historians out there listening that our books' titles get appropriated by some best-selling book and that people buy our books by mistake. Because by accounts that I've read, Randall Hansen's book, which is now getting all this new attention, is actually pretty good and worth reading, and maybe more worth reading than Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury. good luck to all historians out there with getting people to book or buy our books by mistake.
Excellent. Okay, David.
All right. Cheers.
Virtual cheers. All right. Bye.
'Whiskey Rebellion' is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The 'Whiskey Rebellion' is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.